From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
The Florida Supreme Court sends a shockwave into the 2024 election campaign with a pair of rulings that will let Governor Ron DeSantis' six-week abortion restriction take effect, while effectively putting it on the ballot potentially in November. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We are joined today by my colleagues, columnist Kim Strassel and editorial board member Kate Batchelder-Odell. The first ruling Monday from the Florida Supreme Court concerned a challenge to a 15-week abortion restriction that was passed in 2022, but has since been superseded by a six-week ban. And the challengers argued that Florida is not allowed to restrict abortion in this way under a constitutional amendment called the Privacy Clause that was enacted in 1980. And here's what it says. Every natural person has the right to be let alone and free from governmental intrusion into the person's private life, except as otherwise provided herein. And Kim, one thing that is notable about this to me is a pretty good analysis, I think, from the Florida Supreme Court. The challengers to the abortion restriction had argued that in the context of the passage of this privacy amendment, this privacy clause after Roe v. Wade, it was obvious to everybody that abortion was encompassed by the language there. And the majority goes through that. It's a 6-1 majority and says that does not appear to be the case. The people that were originally proposing adding this privacy protection to the Florida Constitution were talking about things like government data collection in the internet age. Here's a quote from one commissioner who 10 years ago really understood that personal and financial data on a substantial part of our population could be collected by government or business and held for easy distribution by computer-operated information systems. And so the analysis by the majority here is that the voters that put this privacy clause in the Florida Constitution were not necessarily thinking about abortion or expecting that it would protect abortion. And notably, though, there's also a second ruling that the Florida Supreme Court issued the same day, and that will put on the ballot another constitutional amendment. And this one is explicitly called Amendment to Limit Government Interference with Abortion. Here's what the ballot summary says. No law shall prohibit, penalize, delay, or restrict abortion before viability or when necessary to protect the patient's health as determined by the patient's healthcare provider, unquote. And so, Kim, if that ends up on the ballot for the November election, when we're going to have a presidential candidate also on the ballot, I can only imagine that Democrats are hopeful that it would get a lot of voters, progressive voters, young voters, to turn out and vote for that, and then maybe vote for Democratic candidates up and down the ballot.
Before we even get to the political aspect of this, just legally, I did think that both of these rulings were very good, very straightforward. They contained a lot of smart analysis. And probably the measure of that is that everybody was mad in the end, right? So the pro-life groups were very happy that they let the six-week rule go forward. They were very unhappy that this ballot measure was approved to go on the ballot, vice versa. The pro-choice people were unhappy that the six-week law was allowed and very happy about the ballot measure. But if you look at what the court did in both cases, as you noted, when it came to the six-week rule, they basically looked at the privacy clause, which was the basis of the argument, did not find really anything in the historical record. You know, this in its way is an analogous to Roe v. Wade. The people who brought this case were essentially trying to get them to find something in the Constitution that would allow them to say that this six-week law cannot stay on the books. And I think this was good as well in that, not having found something like that, they then gave deference to the legislative branch. And they actually have a line here, consistent with longstanding principles of judicial deference to legislative enactments, we conclude there is no basis under the privacy clause to invalidate. And similarly, I thought it was very straightforward and well done on the ballot measure in that the court again exercised restraint and said that its job was to look and essentially decide whether or not the proposed language was confusing or unclear or misleading, that it doesn't contain more than one subject. And it said that it did not. It, quote, the proposed amendment's principal goal and chief purpose is to limit government interference with abortion that is plainly stated in terms that clearly and unambiguously reflect the text of the proposed amendment. So now we know where things stand. As you say, the big question for, I think, Republicans and the Republican legislature that passed this six-week law, this is now going to go to the people. And what we've seen in previous episodes of this is that pro-choice people get this on the ballot. Often what is put on the ballot is far more sweeping than even what was the law of the land or the state prior to Roe v. Wade. And yet, because the binary choice for voters is between what they see as a more restrictive regime versus what is presented to them as reproductive freedom, they have been approving these ballot measures. And in the process, as you note, Kyle, getting a lot of people to come out and vote on this issue that doesn't normally play as heavily in elections.
That's my read of the electoral record since Roe v. Wade was overturned as well. There have been several states that have voted on this. One that I think is instructive is Michigan. Michigan had a 1931 law that broadly banned abortion without very many exceptions. And in the end, what was passed was pitched as something that would reinstate Roe v. Wade, but the pro-life side argued that it went further than that and it contained some exceptions, for example, for health that were undefined and would probably end up being very broadly defined when it got to the courts. Yet that proposal passed with 57% of the vote to 43% of the vote. And Kate, I think there's an argument to be made that if Republicans and pro-life Republicans in Michigan wanted to avoid that, they would have been better off passing some kind of law to override that 1931 statute. And maybe it would be at 15 weeks or 10 weeks or something in the middle that they could take to the public and say, we are pitching toward the middle of the electorate. This is a majority position, and it's Democrats who are staking out an extreme position.
It's definitely true that when voters have been presented with the question and it appears to them that it is all or nothing, they tend to choose all and allow these much more permissive abortion environments than they really might otherwise support. So you could, to some extent, see a replay of what we have seen in Michigan and Ohio and also deeper red states like Kentucky play out in Florida. But at the same time, the Florida electorate is somewhat different from the example of Michigan, whose legislature could not have affirmatively passed a six-week ban law. And so Ron DeSantis has, under his governorship, the state has trended in a more Republican direction. And you also have a large Hispanic population that tends to be more socially conservative. But I don't want to understate the political risks for Republicans that exist nonetheless. And if you try to play out some of this, it's complicated politics for Republicans. Rick Scott is in a relatively competitive Senate race in the fall, trying to hang on to his seat in Florida. You also have President Trump, who has staked out a more moderate position on this issue than some of his Republican colleagues. Trump has suggested that he wants more of a 15, 16-week marker, that that's where he is comfortable with. So you could also scramble the politics that way and leave some of these Republicans in Florida looking much less moderate than Trump does, which I think could redound to the Democratic benefit. So that's, again, we're seeing some of the same story play out. I do think, though, however, it's a live debate. Voters have really only begun to start to suss out their views on these questions. And I think ultimately it vindicates what Justice Alito said in his opinion in the Dobbs case overturning Roe, which is that he couldn't purport to know what would play out in the political arena as the consequences of the decision to overturn Roe. But that wasn't the judge's job. The judge's job was to interpret the law and the Constitution, and that Roe was aberrant and not something that they could uphold. So I do think there are risks for Republicans, but it also is being sorted out in the right venue, which is at least appropriate and healthy for the country.
Hang tight. We'll be right back with more in a moment. Welcome back. I agree with the point that Kate was making before the break, that this is a matter for politics, for state debates. What are the people of the state of Florida or Michigan or Ohio want their laws to look like? This is the correct venue. But Kim, what do you make of the question of Republican strategy in these debates? And I would point again to these figures from Gallup on the national views on when abortion should generally be legal or generally illegal. This is from a May 2023 survey. In the first 3 months of pregnancy, 69% of Americans say abortion should be generally legal, compared to 24% say generally illegal. But it flips in the second 3 months of pregnancy. In the second 3 months, only 37% of Americans say abortion should be legal. 55% say illegal. And notably, that 55% includes 52% of women. So there is polling to suggest that abortion restrictions in the second trimester is the majority position of the United States electorate. And what we keep seeing in these state referenda are states that are going further than that getting blowback. And Ohio is another one where there was a referendum to establish a constitutional right to abortion. And if you look at the exit polls for that, Kim, 19% of Republicans voted yes on that, 65% of independents, which suggests to me that even many Republicans and a lot of independents were not comfortable with where Ohio's abortion laws were. And what they chose instead was to vote yes on this referendum that also maybe went further than they really want to go.
Yeah, the Republicans have been making a couple of mistakes here, and they keep doing it again and again. I think one is catering to a portion of the electorate that is very pro-life, that wants as dramatic as abortion restrictions as it can get. These people are part of the base, and a lot of Republican legislators are listening to them. I mean, Florida, I think, is a good example. It started with 15 weeks. This was something that I would wager is something that many, many people in Florida felt broadly comfortable with. But those Republican legislators ended up listening to the pro-life constituency and came back with a much stricter rule. This is putting, as Kate mentioned, a lot of voters in an uncomfortable position of feeling as though what the choice is that they have in these ballot initiatives is either a law that is more restrictive, makes them a little bit uncomfortable in terms of how far it goes, or something that's more expansive. And it may be more expansive than they actually are comfortable with too, but they'll prefer the rights and the freedoms over the restrictions. So I think that one thing is that Republicans have been teeing themselves up for some of these initiatives on ballots by passing laws that make many people in their state a little bit uncomfortable. That being said, as you know, Kyle, Republicans are more in tune and have been long more in tune with the vast majority of Americans who believe that there should be a date, that there should be some restrictions, that this cannot be a limitless principle. So I think their second mistake has been not going on the offensive on that issue, not being more straightforward about who is out of step with them in terms of views on abortion. And that is obviously the left, who do not share the general and wide-reaching view that there ought to be some limit at a reasonable time. And it's going to be curious to see how long it takes the GOP to get there. They're also continuing to roll around in a fight over whether or not this should be left entirely to the states, or whether or not this is something politicians should have a national view on and push at a national level. They've got a lot of questions to work through.
Let's turn to the effects on the presidential election, because this is definitely going to be an issue that both Biden and Trump are going to need to talk about. Let's listen to a bit of each of them. This is first a Biden campaign ad.
I'm running to make Roe v. Wade the law of the land again, so women have a federal guarantee to the right to choose. Donald Trump doesn't trust women. I do.
And here is Donald Trump. These are clips from a Fox town hall in January.
In this campaign, you've also blamed pro-lifers for some of the GOP losses around the country, and you've called heartbeat laws like Iowa's terrible. I'd like for you to reassure me that you can protect all life, every person's right to life, without compromise.
You wouldn't be asking that question, even talking about the issue, because for 54 years they were trying to get Roe v. Wade terminated, and I did it, and I'm proud to have done it. These are the radicals. We're not the radicals. We are not the radicals. But we're living in a time when there has to be a little bit of a concession one way or the other. And I think I want to get it right. I have to get it right. But without what I did, you would never even be asking that question, because there was no chance that that was going to happen. For 54 years, they campaigned on that issue and nobody pulled it off but me. So I think you're going to be happy in the end. Thank you.
Kate, Florida's been trending Republican for years now, but notable that President Trump won it in 2020 by only about 3 percentage points, or roughly 370,000 votes. So interesting question here, whether having a referendum on the ballot in Florida, as Democrats are trying to get it on the ballot in many other states, including the swing state of Arizona, could maybe put some of these states in play for President Biden.
It certainly could. And to your point, Democrats are trying to get it on the ballot, even in states where abortion rights are not really in contention in the legislature, because it has proved to be so energizing for their base to get people to get out and vote. So it certainly could put Florida more in play for the next election than it otherwise would be. But I do think also that Trump's views on abortion might complicate that, because I think he has described that he has two things going for him, one of which is the core credential with the pro-life movement that he appointed the Supreme Court justices that ultimately decided to overturn Roe, which has been the central goal of the pro-life movement for 50 years. But at the same time, he also has not joined other Republicans in calling for more restrictive abortion regimes like 6 weeks. He is saying, you know, I want 16 weeks, which makes him potentially more palatable to voters who have some heartburn about 6 week bans. Now, I don't think he is necessarily doing that out of political conviction. I think he is trying to discern what the best position for him to take is, and that's how he's landed on this particular point. But I do think even with the energy that Democrats will throw at abortion in Florida, it will be tough to overcome the way that the state has fundamentally become more red in recent years. And that's why I suppose it really is a shame that they're getting something of an assist by having the foil of this 6 week abortion ban. It's probably easy to argue that perhaps if they had stuck with the 15 week ban, this could be less of a live issue. One example I might use for that, a sort of corollary, would be in Virginia when Governor Youngkin was campaigning to flip the state legislature. He said 15 weeks and he rallied every one of his candidates around a 15 week limitation. And the effect of that was to show that Republicans did have an agenda and that they had something that they wanted to do, but they did not want to go all the way to 6 weeks. Now, on that platform, Youngkin did not manage to flip the House, but he did kind of overperform what otherwise might have happened in a year that was good for Democrats. I think there is an ability for Republicans to develop a consensus, but the fact that everywhere else in the country, there's really not a Republican message on this, and that it is really divided, has left voters somewhat distrustful of Republicans on the issue in general. Basically, in that case, in the Virginia case, you had one candidate presenting herself as the Democrat, presenting herself as the lone bulwark between no abortion rights in the American South. And that turned out to be a very powerful message to Democratic voters. So I think the one takeaway here is that Republicans do need to come closer to a unified strategy, because having folks all over the map, I think, is sowing some mistrust and making it difficult to persuade voters.
Hang tight. We'll be right back after one more break. Don't forget, you can reach the latest episode of Potomac Watch anytime. Just ask your smart speaker, play the Opinion Potomac Watch podcast.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. Let's turn now to the House tax deal now sitting in the Senate. After Congress has finally gotten the job done of funding the government, albeit several months late, there is now an interest in Capitol Hill on turning to other legislative issues. And one of those is this House deal negotiated by Ways and Means Chairman Jason Smith. Kate, I know you've looked closely at this bill. Can you give us a sense of what is in it, what the compromise, the deal made was, and whether it's worth Republican support in the Senate?
So this deal passed the House earlier this year pretty broadly with more than 300 votes. And the basic trade is a set of business tax provisions that the business lobby wants, and some of which are tweaks to the 2017 tax reform. And the trade to Democrats to earn their support was substantial expansion of the child tax credit. And so this managed to attract 300 votes in the House, and it has been since sitting in the Senate. Now, our hope has been that perhaps it stays sitting in the Senate for some time. And I think the reason for that is Republicans could have, I think, gotten support for a bill that touched some of these business breaks. For instance, bonus depreciation on assets. Another one is about how you treat the tax treatment of research and development. These are very popular tax breaks that many Democrats also support. So you could see an outline of a bill that dealt with some of these without having to make quite a large welfare and spending concession in the form of the child tax credit. And I use the term welfare and spending because the changes to the child tax credit in the bill basically turbocharge the payments that go to people with children who don't pay federal income tax. So it's really not best understood as a tax bill. It's an expansion of an income transfer just run through the tax code. And I think that that is a mistake for Republicans. I don't think they'll get political credit for it in this election year to the extent voters even notice it. I think Biden would get credit for it. But I also think it would lay more groundwork for Democrats to get across a universal basic income. It basically attenuates how that credit tries to connect work with benefits. So I think it's a bad precedent, and I don't think Republicans were able to get the better end of the deal here. Now, the good news is there really is some heartburn in the Senate among ranking member on the Finance Committee, Mike Crapo, and others who have concerns about the bill. And I think that's why you've seen it stall out in the Senate. And I think it's going to be difficult to pass over the next few weeks.
Kim, do you agree with that assessment? And one thing I would also underline is the context here, because most of the 2017 tax cut package is expiring here in the next couple of years, 2025. And so part of the context for this short-term negotiation is trying to get better leverage for that ultimate negotiation over what is going to happen to the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act when it hits that deadline.
All of this is just mind-boggling from a political perspective, and Kate laid it out very well in terms of what's at stake here in terms of policy, but just politically, first of all, you have all of these Republicans, especially in the House, who spent last year complaining that the recently passed appropriations bills didn't do enough to cut spending. We've got lots of talk about how we need to do more in terms of tackling welfare reform. And yet they don't touch any of the big issues, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. And they're now debating. I mean, there were a lot of votes for this in the House, adding essentially a new expansion of an entitlement, which, as Kate says, could very easily in Democratic hands be turned into universal basic income. Certainly something that could be incredibly costly and become just another Washington, what you expect to get over the years. So there's that. And why are they doing this? It's the, I think, false lure of a certain portion of the party that is now of the belief that there's somehow political gold and chasing after working family votes. It's part of this populist or Republican move. And it's causing them to not think, I think, wisely on bigger questions of conservative principle and what they'll get credit for longer term as well, too. As Kate says, they're not going to get credit for this in the short term. They're likely those in the business community, including small business owners. And I do feel their pain when it comes to this R&D provision, which I think has been very tough, especially on smaller businesses or mid-sized businesses in the United States. I get that. But the pressure ought to be on Democrats who, you know, not that long ago in their own 2021 Build Back Better bill were saying that they were in favor of doing this. And any Democrat ought to be asked if they are in favor indeed of supporting policies that help small and medium-sized businesses in the country. And if they aren't, they should take the political consequences of that. I think in the long term, there are also questions about whether or not this doesn't hurt businesses in that it encourages more people to come off the working rolls at a time when businesses are struggling to find enough workers. So generally, politically and from a policy perspective, a very bad idea. And even listening to those who are supporters of it, I've been failing to understand where they think the political upside is.
Thank you, Kim and Kate. Thank you all for listening. You can email us at pwpodcast@wsj.com. If you like the show, please hit that subscribe button, and we'll be back tomorrow with another edition of Potomac Watch.